right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. We'll play those a little bit later on. Coming up a little bit later this morning, our good friend Kevin Powell is going to join us from WGN Sports. You can hear him doing the sports on Rokan Show with Anna DeBlantes every weekday afternoon. And you can follow him on Twitter at kpowell720. Lots of sports stuff to talk about with Kev. So let's talk about this. It is the Saturday is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, and it's a very exciting thing, and everybody's very excited to celebrate that. And we wanted to talk about that and more with our good friend Rod Pyle. He's an author, a journalist, editor in chief at Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society, and he's written a ton of books. Pylebooks.com is the website, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. He has put together a beautiful book called First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, and a foreword by Buzz Aldrin. And let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, how are you?
I'm good, Nick. How are you?
Good, man. Good.
Other than really hot.
Oh, it's just going to be brutal this weekend. I mean,
you know, I feel for you guys because, you know, I live in a desert by choice, so we expect it to be 115 here in the worst of the summer.
Yeah.
But it's usually like zero humidity, and I just can't imagine what it feels like there now. It must be horrible.
Yeah, I mean, it really is not going to kick in until later this afternoon, and then it's going to be really brutal on Friday and Saturday, and then it'll taper off on Sunday, so.
You know, they could put a man on the moon, but you know the rest.
Yeah, exactly. Again, as we always do, tell everybody about yourself and how you got into writing about space.
So I was born the year before NASA and grew up with the first space race, which was a very exciting time to be alive. And by the by 1970, really, we were seeing these incredible missions of exploration going off to the moon every couple of months, except for a couple of slowdowns due to Apollo 13, and a couple of them were delayed a little bit for other reasons. But basically, the program was just running full smash by 1971.
Yeah,
and it was just an incredible time to be alive and see that stuff. And you know, even when I bemoan my aching joints and so forth, I feel very grateful I was alive for that. But I'm also very optimistic because I think we're on the cusp of seeing it happen again, not just with government, but this time, as we've discussed before, with SpaceX and other companies.
Yeah.
And the international sector jumping in. It's going to be really exciting. So anyway, I got very excited about that as a kid. Wanted to be a scientist or an engineer and went off to UCLA to study astronomy and encountered differential calculus and decided I don't think I want to be an astronomer anymore. So that's what got me into the whole creative and writing end. And then by the mid-2000s, I was starting to write books, and it's just it's a lot of fun. It's a great way to make a kind of a living.
Yeah. It's nice to write about something that you really love and that you're incredibly interested in. You know what I mean? So
yeah. You know, it's a real gift. Yeah. And I thank my lucky stars every day. I make the commute from upstairs to downstairs. Today I had to go out and I've just been doing like a ton of media, five or six radio interviews a day and
yeah.
talk. So I was driving out across LA, which is, you know, across LA is about 28-30 miles from where I live. To go out to Northrop Grumman, which is one of the big aerospace contractors, do a talk out there. And it took me an hour and a half to go that 28 miles. And I thought, boy, I'm glad I don't have to do this every day anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Well, first of all, what's the plans for I know you're, this is a very, very busy time for you, obviously. But what is the plan for Saturday?
Saturday, got kind of an interesting thing set up. I was sort of waiting on, there was a talk of going to Houston or to Florida to participate in some of the stuff there and maybe give a couple of talks, and it just didn't come together, and I was still two and a half months out maybe, and I thought, you know, I don't want to wait and be the guy sitting at home during the anniversary thinking, oh, I wish I was doing something cool.
Yeah.
So I got together with KFI, which is our big blowtorch talk station out here. And I'm on there every couple of weeks anyway, kind of like I do with you.
Yeah.
And I said, let's do a live broadcast from one of the science museums. So we set up a thing with the California Science Center in Los Angeles. So I'm going to be out there with a guy named Neil Saavedra, who does a show for them every Saturday. And we're going to do a three-hour Apollo anniversary and interview some people and talk about space food and technology and play some clips from the era and all that. So it's just going to be a fun kind of a combined stroll down memory lane and looking at some of the cool technologies that made all this possible and where we're going.
Oh, that sounds fun, man. That sounds like a great time.
Yeah.
And
well,
and,
I'd rather do it with you, but if I can't have you, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting to, you know, to turn on my TV and check the cable listings. There seems to be an Apollo special on every channel every day.
Now, have you seen the CNN movie?
Yes, I have.
Called Apollo 11?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it twice now, and the second time I saw it in an IMAX theater, brand new print. And it was a museum IMAX theater, so it's one of those screens that's, you know,
oh yeah,
seven stories tall or
right,
something.
Right.
And I mean, you know, I grew up like you watching all that stuff in 16mm because that's all we thought we had. And in the 80s, I had a meeting. I got very lucky. I got a meeting with the chief of NASA's public relations division at headquarters because I wanted to make a documentary, and I thought they'd give me money. I was really kind of an idiot, but he was very nice. His name was Brian Duff. Really nice guy, great reputation.
Yeah.
Then he made, you know, 20 minutes to talk to me, and I said, is there any, towards the end of the discussion, when it was clear they had no money for me, I said, is there any large format film of any of the launches? And he said, see that corner of my office? I said, yeah. And he said, I had a stack of 35mm film cans of launch footage, and I could not get NASA to pay for it. After about 8 years, I gave up and sent it to the shredder.
Oh.
I was crushed.
Oh.
Not knowing, and I guess he didn't know or didn't remember, that there was this wide format 70mm footage sitting in the archives. So this guy who did the CNN doc found that and transferred it and cleaned it up digitally. And as you saw, it's just unbelievable.
It really is.
You are right there.
Yeah, it really is. All right, Rod, hang on. Hang on a second, okay?
You bet.
You've got to take a break for the news. Rod Pyle is with us. He's our space expert. He's a great guy. And he has written a beautiful book about the Apollo 11 space mission. And it's the 50th anniversary this Saturday. We got a lot more to talk about. Our phone number, if you've got comments or questions, is 312-981-7200. The news is up after this.
1 second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
How did this song not win Best Song at the Academy Awards?
I don't know.
How did it not win?
I don't know how he didn't get the Oscar for Al Cody. Who's that? Adam Driver,
yeah,
for playing Al Cody.
He was hilarious. I love that song. It's a great movie, too. Inside Llewyn Davis.
Breaks my heart every time.
It's so great. Why am I blanking on her name? Carrie, the female lead.
Oh,
British. From. Yeah. Oh, my God. Why am I blanking on her name? Anyway, Oscar Isaac is great in it. A great cast.
So, Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, JT's in it. That's a great movie, a really great movie, and that song is hilarious. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Coming up a little bit later on, our good friend Kevin Powell is going to join us for some sports talk. You can hear him on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantes every weekday afternoon right here on WGN. So we'll do some sports talk, too. Right now, though, we are approaching the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, and we're celebrating that right now. It's Saturday, and we got to talk to Rod Pyle about that and much more, and let's get Rod back on the show. Hi, Rod.
Hi,
Rod.
Hey, Nick.
Hey. So let's talk about the book, First on the Moon. We've talked about it before, but because the anniversary is coming up, tell me about how this book was put together and when you started it and all that cool stuff, because it's really a beautiful book.
So I think it started in 2016 early. It's one of these author's dreams where I got a call from the publisher saying, hey, we want you to do a book. I didn't have to pitch it. I didn't have to write a proposal or anything. I just started working on it. And I'd done two Apollo books before that and kind of a third partial Apollo book. So I already had a lot of stuff. You know, I'd done that Missions of the Moon where I had all those scanned documents and I'd taken photographs of hardware and so forth. So I had this huge library of stuff in addition to things I'd pulled from the archives over the years. So really putting it together was a matter of picking the right things and just writing the text. But I wanted to do something a little different because so many of these things are just a chronological, you know, this happened, this happened, this happened. Then we landed on the moon and the world rejoiced. And those are fine. But I knew there was going to be probably 20 or 30 books out this season because of the big anniversary. So if I wanted to do something a little different, so I just picked areas that I thought were really critically important and interesting, like the key machines and the process of getting to this decision of going to the moon and what it meant to NASA to suddenly have President Kennedy say in 1961, hey, NASA, we're going to the moon. I know we only have 15 minutes of experience in space and we didn't even reach orbit, but make it happen. And they kind of went, yay, how are we going to do this? And then one real special thing was I wanted to interview the kids of Aldrin and Armstrong. And so I interviewed one of each of their sons. And both the interviews were a lot of fun. Armstrong's son's a little bit like him. You know, you got to kind of chat him up to get the material. Andy Aldrin I had known for a number of years already. And we work on a board together and we've done some other stuff. So he's kind of a friend. And he just gave me this killer interview for about an hour and a half. And I think I've told this story before, but if you don't mind, I'll tell it one more time.
Yeah, please.
At the end of the interview, I said, is there anything else? And usually, you know, by the time you've talked to somebody for an hour and a half, they say, no, that's about it. He said, yeah, if you don't mind, I'd like to tell you a story I've never told another writer. And I'm like, oh, yeah, please. And he said, you know, when my dad was on the moon, I wasn't worried that his spacesuit was going to rip or fail because I knew NASA was the best. And I wasn't worried they were going to get stranded in the lunar module because I knew that NASA tested everything until it was perfect. What I was most afraid of at the age of 11 was there was this wire going from the lunar module to the radio dish they had set up. And it was kind of coiled up. It wasn't lying flat on the moon. And I was scared to death my dad was going to trip over that and embarrass me in front of my friends. And I thought, you know, teenage boys are the same everywhere throughout history. So that was a real pleasure. And just the whole book was just a real thrill to put together. And the pictures, one more thing I'll add, it says in the back, you know, previously unseen pictures, which is marketing copy. But what happened was NASA had released a bunch of stuff in 2015, early 2016, a bunch of photos that had been sitting in the archives, but almost nobody pulled them out because during the space race and shortly thereafter, NASA pulled out all the best pictures. And they showed them to the public, sent them to the newspapers and the TV stations and all that. But the other stuff, which in some cases is an accidental picture of a boot because they accidentally bumped the shutter.
Right.
Or most of them are like a panorama. So there's like 10 pictures taken, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in order. And you can put them together and get these incredible compositions. So I hired this photo compositor I knew from my TV days and said, can you put these together afresh and make them perfect? Because there's one famous one we've seen a bunch of times, of Buzz Aldrin in the lunar module shortly before they got into lunar orbit. And it's a composite of about 6 different pictures, but it shows them having like three arms on one side because of the different exposures, and he moved. So this guy went in and picked up from other photos, pieces of the instrument panel and all that. He just made them perfect. So there's a bunch of these in the book. They're on the orange pages.
Yeah.
That show these pictures that we have either never seen or never seen composited like this. And that was just really, really fun to do. And that made it feel special.
Yeah, it is a really gorgeous book. You know, I've gone through it many times I still have mine here at work. I have it in front of me right now, First on the Moon. But I'm not lying here, Rod. Your coffee table book on Mars is on my coffee table at home.
Well, that's a plus. Although you're not going to be there this weekend, right?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm not going to. I'm not. But first of all, you know, I know. Where does the book start? Where do you begin?
It kind of starts with right in the middle of the landing, because I thought, you know, this is was the most intense time. If you were alive then, you were glued to the radio or the TV, but there was no video because the only stuff they sent down in video was the actual moonwalk, and the video was pretty awful. So the only thing we have from the landing is the radio link and 16-millimeter footage shot out the window, which we, of course, didn't see until they got back.
Yeah.
They got processed because that was film back in the bad old days. So I really wanted to add some of the details that we didn't understand at the time, like the fact the computer locked up 5 times during the landing, and they weren't sure if they were going to be able to finish the landing or not because the computer failed. They were done. They had to abort and try and find their way back to the command module where Mike Collins is waiting. So that was a white knuckler. They were off course when they separated the lunar module from the command module. There's a little bit of residual air in that docking tunnel. And it just was the slightest little pop like a champagne cork, but just that extra air was enough to throw them off course downrange 3 miles. So Armstrong's getting down close to the surface, and he realizes, huh, these aren't the craters and the mountains I'm supposed to be seeing. I got to land this thing manually right on the edge of the map where they had drawn this big oval for the landing zone. So he was kind of in Luna Incognita, if you will.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a white knuckler, and we didn't know that at the time, of course, because he wasn't really saying much. He said, we're a little long. Well, NASA knows what that means, but the rest of us are going, what's that mean?
Yeah.
You know, did he talk about what a man he is or something? I don't get it.
Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of stuff happening that was just kind of in the subtext that we only found out later. So I really wanted to get in that narrative. And then I go from there to the beginning of the whole space race and how it happened, of course, because you have to talk about that.
Sure.
And then, like I said, I go off into the different machines because the Saturn V was a huge accomplishment for that era. And we were only a decade and a half out of the Second World War when all this started. And here they are building this magnificent 363-foot-high moon rocket that's the size and about the same mass as a World War II destroyer. And it's got to fly, you know?
Mm.
It's this big, controlled bomb. And the lunar module was the first machine of its kind designed to operate only in space. Very thin, very fragile. Computers were tiny. They had about 36K of memory. They're very primitive. They're about as powerful as a handheld four-function calculator back in the old days.
Yeah.
So all these things together, I thought, just really would make a compelling story.
Yeah. Well, it's really, really great stuff. But talk a little about the three guys. You know, I mean, I've seen First Man, and I know that, you know, and I loved that. I really loved that movie. But, you know, I've talked to you about how some of the inaccuracies of the personalities that they showed in the film. But talk about these three guys and you know, their camaraderie and how they got along and their personalities.
So they were kind of an unlikely crew, you know, that, excuse me, Deke Slayton, who was the head of the astronaut office at that point, he was a grounded astronaut because he had a heart condition. He was supposed to fly in Mercury, but didn't fly till the last Apollo flight. Kids always said, you know, you can interchange my crew guys like cogs in a machine, and it'll always work. And that might have been a little bit of an overstatement, but really, you could put any of these guys on a crew, and they would be fully functional and get the job done.
Yeah.
So as Mike Collins wrote after he got back from that mission and left NASA, and he wrote a couple of excellent books, one called Carrying the Fire, in which he says, we were amiable strangers. And he goes on to say that they worked well together as a team. They communicated fine. They trained for hundreds and hundreds of hours together. And they operated perfectly like a machine, but they probably wouldn't have been friends under other circumstances. So Armstrong is this very quiet, not taciturn, not like he's in the film, but quiet, introspective, intensely curious guy. I mean, he was a real scientist engineer right to his bones.
Yeah.
Had a very wry sense of humor. If you talk to people that knew him, he's the only one of that trio I didn't have the fortune to meet. And just a magnificent pilot. I mean, the guy flew the X-15, you know, that's not easy to do.
Yeah.
As we saw in the film,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So, First Man. So, really just the right guy at the right place for the right job. And when it came to that final part of the descent, and I was on a panel a couple of days ago over at Northrop Grumman here in L.A., I had a couple of guys who were on the team that designed and built and really invented the lunar module descent engine. And they were saying what a magnificent job he did setting that thing down with just 20 or 30 seconds of fuel left, really flying it right to the edge of the capability of the machine and the people. And so he was just the perfect choice.
Yeah.
Buzz Aldrin, very intense, the only astronaut of that group that got a PhD. He got it at MIT in orbital dynamics, I think it was, or orbital mechanics, which was fairly new at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, just reading the course descriptions give me a headache, because the guy's brilliant. He's got five brains in there all kind of working at once.
Yeah.
Didn't mesh terribly well with the other guys who were test pilots. He wasn't a test pilot. And when they wanted to tell stories about, you know, the Korean War, their experiences in aerial combat or their latest conquest or something, and there was Buzz wanting to talk about orbital dynamics and science, and they just kind of didn't get him.
Yeah.
And he tended to speak exactly what he thought, as you saw in the film.
Yeah.
Was, you know, a little over the top. But,
yeah.
But I guess from what people tell me that were there, fairly accurate. And then you've got, so he was just a perfect choice for his role of being, they called him the lunar module pilot, but really he was the guy manning the second stick in case he needed to take over, but watching the computer as they were descending, telling Armstrong exactly where they were and how fast they were going and how fast they were descending and all that.
Right.
And the other thing about Aldrin, as I've said a couple of times your show, is he understood the whole thing of orbital dynamics so well that when on Gemini 12, when their flight computer failed, it was the last Gemini flight, and they were trying to rendezvous with an Agena target vehicle to finish proving docking and rendezvous and all that kind of stuff. The computer failed, and he got out a sextant and a slide rule and a piece of paper and a pencil, and calculated the whole thing by hand, and they actually made their objective and docked using less fuel than anybody previous.
That's amazing.
To that.
That's amazing.
So that's amazing.
Yeah.
And finally, you know, he's the one of that bunch that just never gave up on the message of we got to push further, we got to push harder, we got to keep going. He really has represented ever since the day he came back, really. Mm-hmm. Collins is a kind of a classic raconteur. You know, he was a combat pilot. He was a test pilot. Great sense of humor. Real interest in history and the humanities. He was the kind of guy that you wanted at your barbecue because he could hold forth on just about any subject.
Yeah.
He was a connoisseur of fine wines and French food and a chef and all that kind of stuff. So really, you couldn't pick three more diverse individuals to work together on something like this. Now, you look at the next crew on Apollo 12, and you got Pete Conrad and Al Bean and Dick Gordon. And these guys were like brothers. They loved each other. They spent every moment they could together. And this was really, I think, mostly because of Conrad's personality. He was a great leader and just a warm, loving guy. And he treated these guys like they were family. So completely different picture. And
yeah.
Then from there on out for the rest of the flights, slightly different bunch for each one. But that's probably the biggest contrast between two crews is Apollo 11 and Apollo 12.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He is an author, an expert on space, and it is the 50th anniversary this weekend of Apollo 11 and his fantastic coffee table book, First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience, is truly great. All right, we'll talk more with Rod. We got more space stuff to talk about, not just Apollo 11, but of course, obviously we were leading with that because Saturday is the 50th anniversary. We want more. If you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, and we'll be right back.
And I think it's gonna be touchdown brings me round and get to five.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Triple Play Thursday, a little bit later on, 312-981-7200. Coming up, the stories that matter with Ken Smith in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 mission is this Saturday, and we are talking with Rod Pyle, who is an author and a journalist. He's an editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and he's the author of many books, including this really beautiful coffee table book called First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. And let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Hey, you know what? While during the break there, I was like tooling around online, and I found this really amazing picture, which I'm sure you've seen, of eight astronauts from the Apollo missions who gathered together and took a picture. And have you seen this picture?
Probably. It doesn't ring a bell right away, but I've seen most of them one time or another.
This was a few months ago. They gathered together in March and they took a picture. And have you seen Buzz Aldrin's outfit in this?
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Everybody's in a suit, and here's Buzz in, I think it was one of your Get Your Butt to Mars t-shirts, although I'm paraphrasing there.
Yeah.
And stars and stripes suspenders, and
yep.
On his left wrist, if you see closely, he's got a bracelet of crystal skulls, and on the other wrist, he's got turquoise beads. And I mean, he's just a real trendsetter, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful picture, though. It's very, very cool. Yeah.
It's really nice they got together.
Everybody in tuxes except for Buzz Aldrin.
Right. Hey, that's his thing, man.
Yeah. Hey, tell us about the of Ad Astra. You guys have the 50th anniversary edition of Ad Astra. Tell us all about that.
So I wanted to do something special for the anniversary in print, and I'd already done the book, and I was editing the magazine anyway, and I thought, you know, let's do a special edition. So I commissioned it to be almost 100% over length, so it went from about 50, 60 pages to 100, and put on a nice heavy stock gloss cover, and I knew there were going to be a bunch of special edition magazines out, although there weren't as many as I expected, but most of them are, you know, articles that are interviews with some of the astronauts and a retelling of the story. But I really wanted to get some of the stories that we don't hear much about. And I got so many, in fact, that I'm having to overlap a bunch of them into the next couple of issues. But there is one on, we did an interview with Buzz about a year ago, which went on for quite some length. And he talked a little bit about his experiences and then a lot about the future and, you know, working with China and so forth. And then there was another very comprehensive article about building the Apollo capsule, the command module, and how challenging that was, and the different iterations of it. another one about the lunar module that I wrote, and then a couple of profiles on the crews. I reprinted the stuff from the kids interview that I did.
Yeah.
Of the Sons of the Astronauts. So just kind of an eclectic collection of things. Then one big whopper, I think it's 4,000 word article that I wrote that was an excerpt from the, it was kind of an amendment of what I put in the book. I took two or three of those chapters on the actual process of getting there, landing, and what they did on the surface. So that was kind of the large centerpiece of it.
And is it, can people get it?
Yeah, it goes to all members, but we just, yesterday, actually, or this morning, I take it back, this morning, we got it online on a site called Issue, ISSUU. So if you look there under Ad Astra, and I sent you the link, maybe you can put it up later.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'd
love
to.
Buy it for $6, which is about a third the price of any of the other special editions out there.
Well, that's great, man. That's really great. Okay, one more Apollo thing before we break here. Sure. There is an Apollo 11 immersive live show. Tell us about that.
So this is a guy, this was put together by a guy named Lucas Biglietti, who I know, he lives in Switzerland, and he's a really fascinating guy. I met him at a conference years ago. He is a pilot, so he flies for, I think, Swiss Air. He flies, you know, he flies the big, heavy passenger flights across the Atlantic, but he just has this undying love for Apollo. So years ago, he opened this museum in Switzerland called the Swiss Apollo Museum, fittingly, and they had contributed to one of the experiments on Apollo 11, so that was sort of the centerpiece of it. And he decided, you know, he too wanted to do something special for the anniversary. So he got together with some investors and some theater people, raised $15 million. And so they debuted this in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, our big stadium here.
Yeah.
And it's this huge tent, holds, I think, 800 or 1,000 people. And it's audience on three sides of the stage. So the first half is kind of like traditional museum theater, which you might see. There's a lot of explaining about what was important and why it mattered and some of the intricacies of going there. And it takes the form of a grandfather telling his granddaughter about what this all meant to him and why it's still important. And she's looking at her phone, and he says, "Stop looking at your phone and listen to me." You know, a lot of things you might kind of expect.
Yeah.
And then in the second half, it just takes off. And the staging and the theater craft in this is jaw-dropping. So I'll just mention a couple of things. These aren't spoilers because they've been written up elsewhere. There's this cylindrical scrim about 25 feet across that comes down from the ceiling in the beginning of the second half. And you're thinking, what's that going to be? And it's pre-launch. And they slowly, with a CGI that's projected inside the cylinder, they do a build-out of the Saturn V from the inside out digitally.
Wow.
And then this big rocket sitting in front of you. And it looks life-size. And then it takes off. So they slowly lift this scrim, and there's steam and fire coming out the bottom, and it's all lit up, and the seats are shaking because these speakers and so forth. So the rocket takes off. And then the other highlight, which was just sensational, was across the back of the stage, they have the mission control team facing you over their consoles.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's the landing. And they're going through the high points of the landing. It's very intense, and there's intense music, and the lighting is low. And then from that same cylinder in the ceiling is lowered what looked to me to be a life-size mock-up of a LEM. The quad jets are firing, the main engine's firing, and it comes down, lands in the middle of the stage, and it goes on from there. And I got to tell you, with no shame whatsoever, I lasted about halfway down vertically, and then I started to just sob because it just brought it all back.
Yeah.
And it's so visceral and so present. It was amazing.
And
so,
it's coming to Chicago.
Well, it's traveling, and I'm pretty sure Chicago's on the agenda. I asked, and they said, well, we're working all that out. We have to get the venues lined up, but it is traveling. So over the next 3 years, it'll be going, I think, to 15 cities. So I'm pretty sure Chicago's one of them.
That's great.
And the website is Apollo11show.com if anybody wants to check it out.
Apollo11show.com. Apollo11show.com.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Rod, hang out, okay?
You betcha.
All right, Rod is with us. Rod Pyle is with us. We got more space to talk about. We got to get to the news, which is coming up in just a couple of minutes. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Justin Kaufman in for Steve Cochran starting at 6. Coming up a little bit later, In the show, our good friend Kevin Powell is going to join us from WGN Sports. He does the sports on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantes every weekday afternoon. You can follow him on Twitter at kpowell720. We'll get him in here to talk sports. But right now, we're talking with Rod Pyle, our good buddy here, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine for the National Space Society, and author of just a lot of books, including a beautiful one about the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, which is Saturday. So let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, one of the news stories that Ken Smith just did in his newscast is this whole Area 51 thing. This whole Area 51. And I just wanted to throw it at you to see what you, because I think it's hilarious. I think it's absolutely hilarious. And from your point of view, what you've been seeing this, and what do you think?
Yeah, well, I saw it and I thought, boy, I got to put this hashtag in my tweets because it's going to get a whole lot more attention than Apollo 11 or the stuff I usually put in there. I appreciate the gag. It's something kind of that you might expect out of The Onion. My only concern is, you know, if you do get a big mass of people there, it's going to be really hot. It's a really horrible time of year to be out there.
Yeah.
Because it's in the middle of the freaking desert. And those guys are serious, you know.
Yeah, I mean.
I'm sure they'll be, you know, if they think it's going to happen, the troops there will be set up for it. And I don't think they're going to certainly shoot anybody, but they're not going to be friendly about it. And the few accounts I've read of people who tried to, you know, not only is there the perimeter fence, but there's also signs over the place just in the hills surrounding the area saying, don't come any closer. Lethal force may be used.
Yeah.
They're not messing around. You know, they've got military secrets there they want preserved. So my fear is that enough people take this seriously that they show up and make this kind of ragtag assault with their motorhomes or whatever. It's going to be like that scene out of your favorite movie, Independence Day, with all the motorhomes crossing the desert, you know, with American flags whipping off the back and guys on motorcycles going, let us in. What do you think? I mean, I guess what amazes me the most is how much traction this gets.
That's
so
what I'm talking about.
Celebrating.
Yeah. That's exactly my takeaway from this too is 1.5 million attendees on the Facebook page. What are we talking about here? And I also love the way it's worded. They can't stop all of us. This story's been cracking me up all week. You know,
it's the kind of thing you expect, you know, in the fall of the Soviet Union or something, but not here and not for this reason.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. And I was talking to somebody about this on another station earlier today. They were saying, what do you think the attraction is to these kinds of conspiracy theories, you know, these ideas? And I really think, and I don't mean this to sound at all dismissive, because I know that people get very passionate about this stuff, and I welcome this sense of curiosity, but I think there's kind of a seductiveness to these kind of conspiracies, whether it's Area 51 or the Apollo landing, moon landing deniers. You know, you don't need to go do all the work to get a master's or a PhD in a subject to be a part of it. You just get to read some crazy stuff on the internet and say, this really fires me up,
right,
and I'm excited about it. Now, if you can channel that... And you know, I can't say that there aren't UFO pieces at Area 51. I don't know, because I've never been there.
Yeah.
And they're not interested in having me come in to write about it, for sure.
Right.
So who knows? You know, there are probably some secrets within the government that we'd like to know more about. Is it that one? I kind of don't think so, but I can't say no for sure. But this isn't the way to find out more.
Yeah.
You know?
It's just, but I just think, I find it endlessly amusing. I don't know why. It just, this story cracks me up. You know, and it's one of those stories, like, the news lately has just been sort of ridiculously depressing, you know what I mean? Like, and just, tear my hair out every time I watch the news. But we've had some relief from that. I don't know if you, I'm sure, I think it made it nationwide news. We had a loose alligator in a lagoon here in Chicago, in the city. And...
So somebody's pet that went rogue?
Yeah. And somebody threw, I think we thought it was somebody, it got too big for the person and they put it in the lagoon.
Right.
And it was in this lagoon in the middle of the city, right in the middle of the city. And it became thing. It was like Gator Watch. And people were, you know, they named him Chance the Snapper. And, and all the local news has been covering this alligator thing. Finally, some dude from Florida was flown in. It was all weekend we were covering this. For like 4 days, people were covering this. And everybody was going down to this Humboldt Park Lagoon. You know, like hundreds of people were going down trying to find the alligator and look for the alligator. And finally, an alligator trapper from Florida came in, found it in a day. And now he's like, you know, this guy's a hero. He threw out the first pitch at the Cub game the other day. The alligator has been, you know, taken all over the city, and now it's on its way to Florida to an alligator farm where it's going to live its life and be happy. But this was like one of those distracting, you know, news stories followed on its heels by this thing, by this Area 41 thing. It's just Area 51 thing. So if it's not an alligator story giving us a little relief from the news, then I'll take the Area 51. So.
Well, and there's something about animal stories. I remember there's a friend of mine named Ian O'Neill who edits another magazine for a group called the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. And he was a journalist at Discover News for a long time and so forth. He's another space guy. He's actually got a PhD in heliophysics, I think.
Yeah.
Solar astronomy. And he wrote this story years ago when there was a shuttle launch that was delayed. And somebody spotted a little black speck off of the orange external tank, and they thought, what's that? It turned out it was a bat that had gone up and kind of set up shop on the side of the external tank. And so, you know, just for fun, he started writing this series of stories and tweets and so forth about Bruce the Bat, as he named it.
Right.
What's going to happen to Bruce when the shuttle takes off? Well,
right.
Of course, Bruce is going to unhook and fly away, hopefully, and make it far enough that he's not going to be incinerated. But it became this major thing, and it kind of made his career, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just this cute little thing. It's funny, you talk about alligators and crocs. I mean, I go to Houston occasionally, and you drive around the area where the Johnson Space Center is. There's alligators all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, they're sunning themselves. There'll be a little river going up towards the suburban neighborhood, and there's a gator there sitting on the grassy slope, just kind of minding its own business.
Right.
They're used to it, so it's no big deal. But I can imagine in Chicago, it's kind of a rarity.
Oh, no. It was, I mean, it was like the top story. The coverage of this was insane. And it was,
so it's nice relief. Huh?
Yeah, it was great. And it was really a lot of fun to follow that along. And I just found it really interesting that when this whole thing started, Rod, it was a couple of days before last weekend, and the movie Crawl opened up last weekend, and it's an alligator. It's an alligator attack movie. So there were alligators.
Right.
There were alligators all over. I mean, it was completely insane. But we'll see what happens with this Area 51 thing. I just think, you know, when it hit 1.5 million attendees, I was like, you got to be kidding me! Unbelievable.
Well, and I hope most of them are just kind of tagging along because I think it's fun. You
know,
I wonder what the real number is of people who are dedicated enough to actually try something like that, because it's a big trek. That's not a fun part of the state to be in. You know,
yeah.
It's pretty bleak.
Yeah.
That's why they're there, right?
Yeah, exactly. September 20th is when they were thinking about doing
Man.
This. So anyway, I just, you know, since it was in the news, you know, report, I wanted to mention it to you and see what you thought.
Well, this reminds me of that guy, what was it, about 6 months ago, 9 months ago, that guy, the flat earth guy, flew his rocket because he wanted to get high enough to see that the earth was flat and prove it to everybody.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I think he got up to 5,000 feet or something, and you want to say, dude, go in an airplane. You'll get a jet. They go up to 36,000 feet. You can see everything. But instead, he goes up this thing, gets all banged up when it comes down, and I thought, this is wackiness made tangible. I mean, he spent a good chunk of his adult life and probably all of his savings building this thing.
Yeah.
And we've seen a lot of rockets fly, and they're better than his. So that's not the way to go. But what are you going to do? You know.
All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
Yeah, Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. And we've got some general space stories that Rod wants to talk about. And again, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 on Saturday. And a great way to do it is to pick up a book by Rod. You can check out pilebooks.com. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we've got more space stories. And if you guys want to jump in, if you have space stories or questions or anything like that for Rod, he's here, and it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. It's Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. We'll be coming up later on. It's One Artist, Three Songs, 312-981-7200. Kevin Powell's going to join us a little later to talk sports. Right now, we're talking with our buddy Rod Pyle, who's a terrific writer, author, journalist, an expert on space. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks, sir.
You know, it's interesting that this is a, you know, We got a text here from someone. If anybody has a a question, space related question, and or an interest, it's a talk or text at 312-981-7200. Dan says, aren't all orbit missions and even International Space Station below protection of Van Allen belts? No real prolonged time in radiation, and our eyes a weak spot, saying we are blind to time to Mars. Not sure what that means.
I think what he's talking about, so it's below the most of the magnetosphere, which is what protects us, so the Van Allen belts are part of that, protects us from radiation from space. There's radiation coming from the sun, there's radiation coming from outside the solar system, from all those nasty things out in deep space, further out in the galaxy and beyond. And so when we're in Earth orbit, we're protected from most of that, which is why the space station is such a handy place to do the research we do there. Once you get out to the moon and Mars, there's just all this raw radiation coming in, which goes up many, many times higher as you get out towards Jupiter and Saturn. So, yeah, space is rich with radiation, and it's very dangerous, and we have a lot more work to do to figure out how to protect astronauts from that. It's going to probably involve mostly physical shielding and maybe some electromagnetic shielding if they get that put together. So I think what he's talking about when it comes to eyes is we've seen with Scott Kelly and so forth, when you're in weightless conditions for a long time, your eyes elongate, or I guess they flatten out, so your vision goes south. Usually it's temporary, but not always, and it seems to affect men more than women. And, you know, your bones get brittle because they're no longer being stressed by gravity, and there are all these other changes that take place. Calcium builds up in your system and so forth. So it is a problem. The simple solution to that is to figure out how to engineer a centrifuge on the spaceship so you can spin it where the crew quarters are and give them artificial gravity. It doesn't have to be full gravity from Earth. It can be partial, they think, and that'll be good enough. But it's not something we've tried yet, so we don't really know if it'll work as effectively as we want or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you know, that leads into the first story that that you wanted to talk about, which was radioactive astronauts.
Yeah, so there's another study that came out. So a few years ago, there was a study done, looking at a large group of astronauts, about 400-something of them, trying to see if the radiation of space caused cardiovascular issues. So they looked at astronauts that had never flown. They looked at astronauts that flown Earth orbit. And critically, they looked at the Apollo astronauts. They were the ones that went out beyond this magnetosphere we're talking about into the more radiation-saturated environment. But those trips were very short. You know, the longest was about 2 weeks, the Apollo flights, and there aren't that many of them. You know, there's only a handful, a couple dozen that went out to the moon and back. So really, it's hard to gather good data from that. But just to make sure, you know, that's just me. So I called a flight surgeon I knew at Johnson Space Center, NASA's center there. And so what do you think? And he said, we're all kind of turning our noses up at it because there just isn't enough good data here. So then this other study comes out recently, which I don't know if it was the same data or a different set. It wasn't clear. But it said, you know, we've looked at this and we've done the best we can. And it was 310 American astronauts, 117 Russian cosmonauts. And there's, you know, complete medical histories in all these people from the time they're young on through their career.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Apollo guys. And they said, we just don't see a correlation there. So we know there's danger. We just don't know what it is. The concern with this one was that, you know, it could be a deadly thing to go to Mars. There's also concerns that it might mess up your cognitive function, and you don't want drowsy astronauts who can't think clearly trying to land on Mars. So there are valid concerns here. This just isn't the best way to look at them yet.
And so when these different studies happen, how often have they done studies regarding the radiation issue?
Well, they've done tons of them. It's just, again, you don't have much data to deal with. You've just got the Apollo guys that have left the magnetosphere, left Earth orbit. So the other stuff they've looked at is by sending out sensors. There was famously a radiation sensor on the Curiosity rover activated while it was on its way to Mars and has been activated while it's been on the surface. And it has given us a lot more data points about how much radiation is out there. And we know from people that have worked in nuclear plants, or especially if you were, you know, one of the guys that went in after the Chernobyl or Fukushima accident, or if you were part of the group that suffered from the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombings, you know, we've got well-documented evidence of what happens when you get excessive doses of radiation. But putting it together with extended space flight is tricky.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we also know what happens with a lot of radiation. Godzilla.
Yes. And it's isn't that an amazing thing that lives on? I had a friend that was teaching English in Japan in the late 80s, early 90s, I think. And he was there when they were filming another rubber suit Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
You know, those just never go away.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody stole the Godzilla suit.
No.
And this became a national crisis.
Oh,
I mean, it was all over the news. They're pleading, please bring it back. No questions asked. Here's a bounty. I mean, it was this national emergency.
Wow.
Because Godzilla-san had been made off with, and I thought, hey, you got to have your priorities. You know, we worry about presidential administrations and excessive heat warming across the country, and they were worried about their rubber suit.
Well,
my answer was make another one.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that's actually kind of, I mean, as a ridiculous Godzilla fan, and I am a ridiculous Godzilla fan. When you said that, I was just like, like that was a. I seriously was like, somebody stole a Godzilla suit. That's so.
Okay, so did you see the new movie?
I did. Did you?
How was it? I didn't know. I saw the one before that, which I found a little confusing, but I kind of liked, especially that was the one with all the giant ticks in it.
Yeah.
That one a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And when Godzilla, you know, breaks open the jaw of that thing and breathes fire down its
mouth,
I thought, you know, it was worth the price of admission just for that.
Oh, yeah.
What was the new one like?
I loved it. You know, Tom, my producer, is another Godzilla maniac, and it was not well received. It was very negatively received. But I thought it was great. I thought they made a very good, typical, wonderful Godzilla movie, and I was happy about it.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Rod, can you hang out for a minute?
You bet.
Okay, good. Rod Pyle is with us. We got more space stuff to talk about. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk or text. And we'll break here. The news is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Kevin Powell is going to join us to talk sports after 3, and we got a lot of sports stuff to talk about, and he'll be joining us to talk that. And then we're going to be talking about how movie titles get translated in different countries and how hilarious some of these are. We also have some corporate logos that everybody recognizes we can chat about, too. The phone lines and the text lines are open. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And we are talking with our good friend Rod Pyle, who is a great author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. Again, the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 is on Saturday, so we had Rod to talk about that. There are other space things to talk about, so let's bring Rod back. Rod, thanks for hanging out with us.
You got it, sir.
All right. Another thing you wanted to talk about was space spinoffs. Let's talk about that.
So this is an old story for NASA. They've been publishing a publication called Spinoffs, interestingly enough, since the 60s. And we've all seen the documentaries where they talk about, you know, modern computing came from NASA and all the money invested in the program goes back into the economy, which is true. And what they don't say often enough is two things for my money. One, that money isn't launched into space. It's spent here on the ground on American workers and American products. And two, it's one of the few things that government spends on that's built entirely in the U.S. Every part of the space program is done here by U.S. workers, and that's a huge plus to the economy. But this latest thing that came out, it was an article that came from one of the NASA centers, was talking about some of the things we don't think about as much, like radiation-proof microprocessors, which are very important in the military for obvious reasons. You want to be able to fight in a radiation-rich environment. So that was kind of a big deal. They're expensive, but they're incredibly robust, and it's something that some of the foreign militaries are still trying to replicate.
Mm-hmm.
The modern artificial limbs that people have artificial muscles in them and these incredibly delicate sensors that allow you to be able to actually use the fingertips in a meaningful way to grasp things, the proper pressure and all that, and these really robust joints that are in them, are an outgrowth of the arm development for various parts of the space program. One that I hadn't thought of was anti-scratch lenses on glasses.
Oh.
Originally came from wanting to make sure that the helmets didn't get scuffed up when you're on the moon, right? Because that's very sharp dust. It hasn't been abraded by any weather, so it's incredibly sharp. So that was something they spent millions and millions of dollars developing. Flame-resistant suits, like what race car drivers wear, came directly from spacesuits when they realized they had a flammability problem in the 1960s due to that Apollo 1 accident. So they learned very quickly how to flame-proof those. And that was a kind of a crash program that resulted in a lot of benefits. And finally, another one I had thought about was the Dustbuster, is, you know, a little portable battery-powered vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
Was the spinoff from what they had put in the lunar module so that those guys could vacuum up when they got back, because the whole interior was coated with moon dust, which is very fine and, as I said, very abrasive. You don't want to breathe it because it can cause cancers and so forth ultimately. So that was yet another one. So I just thought it was a cute story because it reminds us of how much of our life is kind of saturated by things that have come not directly from space, but because we went to space.
Yeah.
These developments.
You mentioned, moon dust. What about moon rocks? Where can people see them?
They're in a lot of museums, especially this year. There were a lot of requests, and NASA sends them out under, you know, fairly strict security and shipping regimens. And I know there's one up in Seattle. There's one in an L.A. museum. Most of the major science museums that I've been to have at least a small one, and they're usually encased in a lucite pyramid, so you can see them. And they're kind of unremarkable looking. They look like a chunk of kind of sparkly charcoal. But I could probably dig up a list and send it to you to put up later, a link if you want to.
Yeah. I was wondering if we had any here in Chicago, because we have, you know, we've got the Field Museum and the Museum of Science and Industry. And my guess would be that the Museum of Science and Industry would be the one that would might have.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah, but we'd have to check to make sure.
Yeah. Okay, we got a text here, and this is you know, we talk about this all the time, Rod, every time you're on. Greg says, a friend of mine told me that the Earth will be hit by an asteroid in October. What do you know about that?
Well, they'd certainly be sounding the alarm bells if that was true. Now, if it's a small asteroid, I don't know the particular story he's talking about.
Yeah.
There are small ones that make grazing passes every now and then. But, you know, when people start getting worried about this is any time it's inside the orbit of the moon, which is 240,000 miles away on the average. So that's usually what those stories are about. If a decent-sized rock was coming to the Earth and people knew about it, the story got out, as you know, better than I, because you do news all the time, this would be a huge headline, and we'd be, you know, seeing suggestions about, okay, we've got to get a program going right now, and we better have the Russians send some of their nukes up, because they're ready to go, because they've been working on that, because that's a mission they want to try to do, is nuke an asteroid and see what happens, and so forth. So, no, we're not going to get hit by a large asteroid
yeah.
anytime soon, because if we knew that, we'd know it, and we'd be very, very concerned, and actually doing something about it, which would be refreshing.
Yeah. But asteroids pass by us. They whiz by us pretty regularly, correct?
Yeah, all the time. And it's kind of a shooting gallery out there, which is one reason that there's been this increased emphasis since the Obama administration increased funding for looking for these things by a factor of 10 back in the about 2010, 2011. And the problem is, you know, you can only catch so many of them from the ground because they're dark and they're far away and they're small. So they've been trying to get orbital telescopes funded whose specific role is to look for the slightest indication out there in various methods so that you can spot these things far enough in advance. Because if you can reach them when they're way out there, you remember your basic trig, you know, you have a very small deflection when it's far away and it's not going to hit the Earth. But if you wait till it's closer, you're probably not going to be able to do it because you won't be able to have enough motive force to push it out of the way.
Oh, right.
So detection is the first big part of it, and then deflection is the second part. And we've talked before about the DART mission, the double asteroid redirect test that's going up, I think, in 2023 or 24, depending on when it can get a launch slot. And it's a kinetic impactor. It's a spacecraft that's going to go out to a small asteroid that has a very much smaller moon orbiting around it. Asteroids, some of them actually have their own little moons. And it's going to slam into that smaller moon. I think it's about 50 or 80 feet across, just to see if we can actually successfully do this deflection. And if it's enough to actually make a difference, and then if that works, we have to start engineering bigger and bigger units to be able to take out some of the big ones.
Yeah. All right. Okay. And another story that you sent to us that you wanted to talk about, goodbye International Space Station?
So we've known that this thing would have a limited life since we started planning it. So it became operational in 2000. It's 19 years old now in terms of how long people have been living in it. It's getting old, right? So we keep changing out parts of it, but it's very labor-intensive. Most of the components have to be done from the outside. They involve these long spacewalks that are expensive and hard to do. And at this point, the astronauts on the crews are spending upwards of 50% of their time doing maintenance and upkeep and rejuvenation for this thing. So it's getting tired, and it's expensive. It's about $3 to $3.5 billion a year of massive money that it takes to run the booth, and then some more from the international partners. So there's been a lot of grousing about, you know, how long are we going to keep this thing? Originally, we were talking 2024. Then Congress got kind of bent about it and said, look, we've already paid for this thing. Let's keep using it. So they upped that to 2028. But with this renewed focus for NASA on returning to the moon, they want to try and offset some of these expenses. So they've looked at two things. They finally, after years of people asking, they're going to let tourists go up there. I think we talked about that last time. It'll only be a handful of them a year. You can stay for 30 days, but it's going to cost you about $50 to $60 million for the seat to get up there. And that just goes to SpaceX or whoever's flying you up. And then about $35,000 a day goes to NASA. So it's not going to add up to much. So I wouldn't call it a stunt, but it's certainly not going to be a big deal changer. What may be a deal changer, and what NASA's been looking at for a number of years now, is trying to increasingly privatize the station. There's a lot of medical research and material science that you can do up there that you can't do on the Earth. One example is there's a type of optical fiber that's like, I don't know, 50 or 100 times more efficient than what we can make on Earth that can only be made in zero-G. So they're looking at trying to partner with corporations to offset or take on a percentage or perhaps most of the cost of running the thing. The problem is it's really not optimized for manufacturing, so it's hard to say whether it would be cheaper to actually repurpose the space station as a corporate sort of endeavor or to just build something that's purpose-made to do what they're trying to do. Mm. So it doesn't even have people on it, probably. So it's an ongoing conversation, but at a certain point, we've got to just face up to, look, this thing's old. It's lived its life. The Russians want their, they put up the first module, which is the power and propulsion module that powers the station and pushes it out of the way when something's coming that they need to avoid. The Russians want it back. You know, they want to use it for other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they want to be able to do that by the early to mid-2020s. So there's a whole bunch of parties pulling in different directions that are trying to figure out what the fate of this thing should be.
Yeah. Because I'm talking about the cost. Is there a waiting list for people who want to go out there? I mean, we're talking about people who have a lot of money.
Yeah, there's been a handful. You know, starting in, I think, 1998. Actually, there was a couple of people who went up to the Russian Mir station because the Russians, you know, they're happy to sell you a seat. They don't care.
Yeah.
NASA's complaint was always that, you know, these people are going to get in the way and they're not astronauts. They don't know what they're doing. They're going to have to be trained. So
yeah.
There's an opportunity for private companies to do that as well, to train these people to do that. So they'll be given some basic tasks to do. But, yeah, it's a rich man's game. Rich person's game, and it's something that is going to happen in very, very small numbers. That said, there are a number of companies working on commercial space stations that would be entirely resort-oriented, so you'd be able to go up and spend, you know, a weekend up there, your honeymoon, or a month, or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
They're generally, some of them are rigid, a bunch of them are so-called inflatables or expandables, like we've seen tested on the ISS. And they work really well. You know, they're basically like a big balloon up there that you can go inside of, and it's got windows and accommodations and all that. They haven't flown those yet with people in them. They just tested them on the space station. So there's a budding industry there, but it's a long ways off, at least 5, 6, 8 years probably.
But people have already, like, signed up.
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah. I mean, there's been a long waiting list for a long time. It's just NASA said no. So people would go to the Russians. The Russians would say, okay, you know, you can go visit our part of it. And they've done that a number of times, and it's been fairly successful. There haven't been any major mishaps. It's just something that NASA really dragged their feet on. Then they finally said, well, okay, but I personally can't see how the math works out, because when you're talking $3 to $3.5 billion a year of expenses, it's going to take a lot of tourists to go up there and make you any kind of revenue that's going to put a dent in that.
Yeah, yeah, wow, that's just crazy. All right. Hey, Rod, hang on for a second, okay?
Sure.
All right. When we come back, I want to talk about you when you were working in the entertainment world there, working on TV and stuff like that. I want to. We haven't really.
Sure.
We've only touched on that, and I want to dive into it a little bit more after we break. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Rod Pyle is with us, a great author and great guy, and you can check out pylebooks.com. And he was in the entertainment world for a while, working on sci-fi TV shows and movies and things. We're going to get some stories from that right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Triple Play Thursday is starting a little bit late this morning, but we'll get to it. And that, if you want to jump in for your requests, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Kevin Powell's going to join us after 3 o'clock to talk sports. And there you go. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Ken Smith in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, hanging out with us is Rod Pyle, space expert, author. We were talking about the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and a bunch of other space stories. And Rod, welcome back.
Thanks. I want to mention before I forget, if you don't mind, the Apollo book has been on sale for a while on Amazon. So it's, instead of $30, it's $15. I have no idea why they did that, but that's good for us, right?
Well, wow. I mean, considering how great the book is, that's a bargain, man.
Yeah, and free shipping. So,
wow! All right, go to Amazon. It's got the Apollo book. Rod Pyle's Apollo book is on sale for half price, $15. And trust me, I've got the book. It's worth a lot more than $15.
And also, BarnesandNoble.com has it as well. I should mention.
Very cool. All right. Okay. We have a very strange text here, Rod. We are around the full moon, so sometimes. You know, the phone calls and the texts get a little weird, as you're probably aware. Hi, my name is Danny. My buddy told me that if you've ever smoked a menthol cigarette, you cannot go to space because as soon as you leave the atmosphere, your lungs will crystallize. is that true or what?
I've never heard that, but, you know, given the rate of smoking that was going on with those test pilots back in the early years from Mercury to Apollo, I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
Most of them quit, but I remember reading there was an article where they interviewed a bunch of them about their smoking habits, and most of them had. Some of them smoked pipes. Most of them smoked cigars, though they didn't inhale, but you still get secondhand.
Yeah.
And then a lot of them were cigarette smokers, and they usually quit by the time they're midway through the program because they just knew it was a good idea.
Yeah.
But never heard that about menthol. That's a new one by me.
All right. Well, maybe I think your
thanks for trying, man.
I think your buddy might have not. I told you a lie, Danny. I'm not sure. So, all right, Rod. You know, you worked in the entertainment industry for a while working on TV. What are some of the things that you worked on?
I worked on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, very briefly on TNG, but just was kind of a day helper. And then I worked on Deep Space Nine for 3 seasons. Always got hired. I was like the last guy on, and they had always shot the credit roll by then, so I don't think I ever actually got on a credit roll.
Oh, no.
So it doesn't matter. I mean, they don't pay any more for that.
Right.
But I was working in the effects department, so we had a shop down the street from the main lot because we were non-union, so we rarely went on the lot unless it was to, you know, help supervise something on the set, which was mostly done by other people.
Yeah.
So it was this big metal shed down the street. And I had a desk underneath this old rusty staircase, so every time somebody went tromping up the steps, rust flakes would fall down on my work, and I'd have to kind of brush everything off to get started again.
Jeez.
But we had this huge set of motion control rigs there, because this was in the days of models and miniatures.
Yeah.
So you had these big rigs that you had the camera on. You've probably seen them. So the model's stationary, and the camera's moving, and it's doing the flybys, a frame at a time. And you do 8 or 9 or 12 of those, and then you'd go in the digital editing bay at great expense in those days. I think it was about $1,000 or $2,000 an hour. And
Jeez.
You'd composite these things together. So you'd have the main lighting pass, the deflector dish pass, and the pass for the lights, the portholes, whether they were fiber optic or sometimes they were a reflective material. And you'd put these things together. And these guys were just masters of this. So my job was to help build. We built cardboard ship models to do simulated passes to plan while the other ones, the real models, were tied up, because those miniatures were anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000. They were expensive.
Mm.
So, you know, they can only kind of work on one rig at a time. So I'd build those mock-ups, and then I'd repair the models when they got broken and clean them up and so forth. And then we had a book of standard Federation colors, so you knew how to go in and dial in all the right colors for everything.
Right.
It was really labor intensive, and you know the upside was the work was beautiful when it was done. The downside was, as we've talked about before, you got a lot of shots of Sisko bouncing in his chair saying fire phasers, deflectors at half, and all that. When you really want to be seeing the big battle scenes, but they're expensive to do. I think the most fun part once was, and we did a bunch of different stuff, but one of the really cool things was we had a big battle scene. We needed a bunch of ships in the distance. And, you know, normally you just keep you do a couple of shots of the miniature from different angles and then just keep compositing it in, but that's expensive.
Yeah.
So they sent me down to the Hallmark store and I bought out their supply of Star Trek ornaments and we just hung them up in the background and said, okay, there they are. They're not moving much, but there they are. So I worked on those shows. And then I worked on a Joe Dante pilot for a series that never went into production called The Osiris Chronicles. I think it was later renamed Warlord Battle for the Galaxy or something. And it had some kind of B talent in it for the most part. Rod Taylor was in it. He was the 1A list star.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was a very big, very expensive show, but I think I was the fourth visual effects supervisor on it. So I actually got promoted while I was working on it. But it was just this long, endless, you know, kind of a goofy story. It was Joe Dante, so it was very comic book, and he does some things very well. Space opera isn't one of them. And it did get seen, and it went on a VHS, but disappeared pretty quickly. So that was kind of forgettable, but it was fun to work on.
Yeah,
and
I would imagine.
Finally,
yeah, go ahead.
When they were doing the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, I set up a little effects shop with a guy I had worked with on Trek and Gary Hutzel, and we spent, I don't know, probably a year doing the early work. So they call it pre-visualization. It's like, what's the ship going to look like? How's it going to move? How's it going to fire? How are the Vipers going to fly? What are their weapons going to look like? And so on. I actually even wrote a little bit because they asked for some script pages to contextualize these shots. So we worked on that for about a year, and then the whole thing went up to Vancouver, and I stayed in L.A., so that was the end of that. But it was a blast to work on. I think the weirdest thing I remember was Gary, my partner, coming back from a meeting he had with the writers, and they were trying to figure out what the new Galactica should look like. And it ended up kind of looking like the old one, but at one point they were really casting around, and he came back shaking his head. I said, what happened this time? And he said, they want me to make it look like a Frank Lloyd Wright building. I said, really? I thought, actually, that could be kind of cool, but I don't think so. And it was CGI, so we could do whatever we wanted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Time, but,
yeah.
But this was in the day, you know, this is about 2000, so you had to shoot or you had to put these scenes together and then send them out to a render farm. I think we were using one in Arkansas, where they had a couple thousand PCs all wired up.
Yeah.
And they'd send you back a frame at the end of the day, you know. So it was pretty grueling at
wow.
the time.
Wow. What did you overall, did you enjoy the experience of working on those things?
I did. You know, it was really, I mean, Trek was the main thing because it had just been a lifelong ambition to be involved with it somehow.
Yeah.
And this guy who brought me in, actually, I had hired him in TV commercials in his first gig in California. And he worked for me there for a few years, and then he got onto the show as an effects guy. And I kept begging him, I said, get me in there. He said, I can't, we're not hiring, we're not this, and we need that. And finally, after a few years, he was able to get me on. So it was a great experience.
Yeah.
And I left it when we stopped using the physical miniatures because it just wasn't as much fun.
Yeah.
You know, Galactica was different because we were sort of starting at the beginning from scratch. But on Trek, I really missed the miniatures, so
yeah.
That was when I drifted off and started making documentaries. But, boy, I sure enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's fun, man. Okay, Rod, always a pleasure, and have a great time on Saturday with your celebration and your show and all that stuff.
Thank you much, and you stay safe and indoors, pal.
Okay, buddy, I'm going to. All right, see you, Rod.
Okay,
take care. Rod Pyle, he'll join us again next month. Always a lot of fun to have him on. All right, we're going to break. We got the news coming up right after this.